You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 87, God Told Me To, and the other wacky transmissions from exploitation auteur Larry Cohen, featuring black bucks, religious cults, ancient gods, a mutant baby trilogy, seductive hitmen, icky perverts, killer junk food, suburban vampires, runaway ambulances, original gangsters, truck-driving serial killers, and Eric Roberts' mullet. Martin.
Yes.
Well, you know what they say. There's only one cure for old age. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, it's another one of your rabbit holes that you've chosen. So tell me, why Larry Cohen?
You know, we did it obviously last week with Franco and Castellari. Cohen was, it was Ambulance. So my good friend Derek, friend of the podcast, Derek Baxter, texted me and says, have you ever seen Ambulance? And I'd seen the trailer for often. I usually watch like 80s and 90s like trailer just compilations on YouTube when I'm just kind of fucking around. And I remember like, that looks crazy. And I'd never seen a lot of Larry Cohen. And obviously we did a whole episode on Maniac Cop and us both being big fans of that series, and he wrote those. But I hadn't seen a lot of his directorial films. And I watched Ambulance with Val, and we both were just like, what the fuck is this movie? And again, Derek,
it is a truly insane curio.
Yeah, and Derek, my friend, is very much a cut from the same cloth as you and I, where you find that genre film, you're like, everyone needs to see this right now.
Yeah.
And this is one of those movies. Like, I watched it and I was like, holy shit. So I said, I just started watching his other stuff that I had not seen before with new eyes. And I same thing with, like, I had this like kind of chip on my shoulder, like we talked last time about Italian films and post-dub and things like that. Same thing with Larry Cohen. I'd always seen them in kind of like the not fairest light of sometimes they look kind of cheap, you know, a film like parts of Q.
They all look very cheap, but you could also argue that's the feature and not the bug.
Exactly. And I think that's where it changed for me is I said, oh, the insanity of how he makes these movies, the sense of true danger and true iconoclastic filmmaking. But through that, like I was like, I had seen it before. I'd seen Q before. I'd seen the stuff. And with Eric Roberts' character in Ambulance, I said, wow, what a schmucky lead character. But what a fun, wonderfully written character. And everyone's great in that movie. And then I said, well, I'm just going to start watching more of his stuff. And then I was like, oh, well, this has that wonderful weirdness to it. And I just really kind of fell in love with his writing first and foremost, and just his crazy filmmaking, like the impossible filmmaking of his films.
It's like, weird because his movies feel very writerly and structured while at the same time incredibly loose in their construction.
Yeah.
Like when you get to when you break down, you know, a script for Cue the Winged Serpent or The Stuff, or even Ambulance, the Ambulance, we should call it, not to be confused with the Michael Bay movie that we've also covered.
And love.
and love to death. And also has a similar sense of danger because, mm-hmm. I mean, like, the Ambulance is one of the better late Larry Cohen movies. While still kind of being a curio, it has all of his fingerprints on it in that it's like he almost makes not even like genre mashups, but like genre like splatter paintings where you can see that he just takes a canvas and he's like, all right, what if I have like a little bit of like a paranoid kidnapping thriller and like a little bit of like a runaway vehicular horror movie, but also maybe like a little bit of like this kind of off-kilter romance between this cartoonist and a cop, which is so strange. But also, like, maybe we throw the little bit of, like, Cohen's secret sauce in there is that his movies all have – it's not even it is subtext in some cases, but it's also just text in that he's sitting there and it's going to, like, contain his personal viewpoints on, like, some kind of American system of power.
Yeah,
and
in
the ambulance, it's the healthcare system or the healthcare institution, to your point, because and he always like has this very acidic view of a lot of these institutions and how they kind of like crush, you know, people on the street, which makes sense because he's a guy he's a born and bred New Yorker and he has a very distinctly New York point of view.
Yeah. And it has a, it was funny. Val was watching a lot of these with me, and I kind of was like, I think this guy doesn't trust a lot of institutions here. And I'd start a new one, and she's like, what is he afraid of today, Martin? You know, and it was pretty much throughout his entire career, like, you know, it's like police, it's the church, the Catholic Church, religious systems, hospitals. I mean, especially with like even his early blaxploitation stuff, it is just the city government and the police and the corruption.
And it's also interesting because it is that thin line. And I do also think that this is a very like New York and Northeastern kind of thing, is that like that thin line, like you're almost like tiptoeing along the crack in the sidewalk of having like an informed and intelligent point of view on these things and being a complete crackpot.
Yeah.
And like he really tiptoes the line to where there are times where you're like, if you handled this even slightly different, slightly to the left, like you would come off like a ranting lunatic, like old man yells at cloud shit.
Well, we were talking about this offline. We were texting last night is, you know, there's a libertarian bent to his films.
Also a very like old school, like New York Jewish bent too.
Exactly. Well, that's just the case. You can't trust X, Y, and Z. You know, it's always been that way.
They're always going to fuck you.
Yeah. They're always going to screw you over. And, but it really, I mean, it begins with Bone of you have maybe his most political film. Cause it's a really shocking film where, and I'd never seen it for our listeners of, really kind of almost like a chamber piece of...
It's almost like his Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Nope. And I think they even talk about that in the King Cohen doc of like, what if, and you have this like comedy of errors, miscommunication, but it's Yaphet Kotto as this kind of probably a spirit, as people talk about in the documentary, but
yeah.
he's a large black man who shows up to out of
a
nowhere.
Big black buck, as he describes himself.
And he's great in it. And he is there to out of nowhere clean their pool when they need it. And then ends up just kind of putting a wedge between an already very rocky marriage. And you have, it's really interesting because it is something that you're saying that goes throughout his entire filmography is this kind of disassembling of an institution. And in this case, it's a marriage, right? And the lies that they've told each other, especially the husband. You start out, he's this supposed to be wealthy. He sells Rolls Royces and Bentleys, like high end, like Beverly Hills, because it's in Beverly Hills, cars. And they live this very opulent kind of lifestyle, this in Larry Cohen's house, his real house. They have a son who's fighting in Vietnam, they're very proud of. But the film, when Bone shows up, is he just picks away at the lies that these people have based their reality on.
Yeah, it's all about perception,
yeah,
and public perception of like different classes of people too,
yeah,
that he's playing with, because like, you know, what we find out, one of the big reveals, and we shouldn't give too much of this movie away if people want to seek it out, which it's unfortunately kind of hard to find now. It used to be I know Anchor Bay had put it out, or maybe Blue Underground had put it out
that
at
would,
one point.
That would track, yeah.
Because they put out a lot of his movies, especially like the Maniac Cop movies that Bill Lustig worked on. And some I
and
know they
friends,
put out,
obviously,
and,
so, yeah.
And God Told Me To. Exactly, yeah, yeah. They're really close. They've been really close for years and worked together numerous times. But like, they pick apart like how people want themselves to be perceived versus how they actually do live. Like, because the big reveal is that it's all on credit. He's broke.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any actual money. He even
stole
tries
from his wife. Yeah.
Yeah. When like Bone takes his wife hostage, he even tries to get the ransom that he's going to pay on a loan, you know? And then at the same time, he gets mixed up with this kind of bohemian girl and goes to her apartment. They cook and they talk about like sexual promiscuity versus, and these are kind of older white, almost like what we would call boomers in our day.
Yeah.
They're the greatest generation.
Yeah.
You're probably
he's
saying.
Only 47 years old, but he looks 70.
Yeah. He looks like 96.
Yeah.
But you're watching it and it's very much like a response to, you know, this like class divide, this age divide, the difference between like black and white people, and you know, the hippie kind of lifestyle of embracing sexual freedom versus like traditional values. Like, these are all things that he is like interested in his first movie, and he cobbles them together in a pretty coherent fashion.
It's pretty impressive.
It's really, really good for a movie that's very small, but also like it's the one thing. And I texted this to you while I was watching Black Caesar, is that for a guy who has a very an increasingly progressive worldview, as you kind of dive into his filmography, he also is like not afraid to embrace the sleaziness of exploitation filmmaking, because like Bone tries to rape, you know, the guy's wife. There's a lot of like talk and then, you know, indulgence in, you know, interracial relationships. Like, he's testing the waters and testing taboos.
Molestation stories.
Monologues about molestation. Like, he is like, if people are going to sign up, and you can almost tell it's sort of like a writer weaponizing his own words, is that he's like, well, I don't have a whole lot of money. We're basically, we have this house. We can shoot most of the interiors inside of it. The rest, like, we can piecemeal together. But like, it's like you said, a chamber piece. And he's like, well, if people are signing up, I don't have a huge budget to do like a whole lot of action or set pieces or anything. So how do you weaponize these words and make it shocking and make people sit like straight up in their seats? And he's pretty successful. I mean, I just finished it last night and I hadn't seen it in some time, and it's still pretty shocking even now. What, like over 50 years later? 54?
It was 1970, so 56 okay. years.
Yeah, it still gets under your skin.
Well, and I kept thinking of, honestly, weirdly, the film Baby Girl, of you have this figure who comes in as almost like a symbol to
right.
shake up the reality of this marriage and the lies, or just the assumptions you have of how you present yourself of the happily married couple. And also, like you said, the kind of almost like puritanical view of sex.
Yeah.
And cause you had that awesome scene in Bone. One of the more interesting segments is when, cause you have this husband character who, you know, when you first meet him, you're like, oh, this guy, it's a hostage situation. He's going to go to the bank, get the money, get back. Because he gives him a time schedule. It's like, if you're not back by 3, I'm going to rape and murder your wife.
Right.
That's like, that's the promise. And
it's pretty cut and dry.
And there's this moment where he's really antsy. And he thinks it's almost 3 o'clock. He's like, oh, my God. And someone's like, oh, no, 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 it's only 2:30. He goes, oh, I guess I'll go get a drink then.
Yeah.
And so it's this weird thing of, you're like, wait, 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 wait. Like, what the fuck is going on here? And you realize, you're like, oh, this guy is using this as an out, you know, out of his marriage. And it's kind of has a, you know, very new Hollywood-y looseness to it of, and then he meets this girl and then he goes home with her. And then he hangs out at a grocery store where she tells him about how she steals food. And like, what's
almost like a Bob Rafelson movie.
Exactly. It had a Five Easy Pieces kind of vibe to it. And which I really found, really attractive. But then you have that whole scene where she tells about her it's a really well-written scene. It's really hard-hitting where she's talking about she would go to the movies, which is what Larry Cohen used to do. And there was the kids section and the adult section. And she ends up and she goes to the adult section and ends up being molested, but she didn't want to be kicked out. So she didn't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. And it even tells her mom. And she has this whole thing about, like, you know how embarrassing it is to be kicked out of a movie? And it's just like a, whoa, like you're talking about the thing, but not talking about the thing. And he's such a good writer, the way he's able to handle that scene.
Well, and a lot of that, again, is like, it comes from, it, Cohen's such an interesting guy, like biographically, and you can watch, I know that you watched the documentary King yep. Cohen that came out, unfortunately, the year before he died. King Cohen came out in 2018, and yep. you kind of saw a little bit of a revival in his work. People were showing it again and everything, and then Larry Cohen, unfortunately, died the very next year, 2019, yep. and I got to interview him for King Cohen at the time. He's like one of the nicest, sweetest dudes. Like, literally talked to him for an hour and a half. He had a trouble with his landline at one point where it was cutting in and out. So he just gave me his cell phone number so we could keep talking, because like, he just genuinely, like, if you showed interest in his work, showed that you like know his work in and out, like he respected that, and he would just engage with you and be like, yeah, ask me whatever question you wanted. But he came from the world of television. Yeah. Like, he originally wrote for a lot of old, like in the late 50s, all up through the 60s, and even had his own television programs in Branded and The Invaders,
yeah.
both of which were pretty revolutionary and subversive works of like mainstream entertainment, because like The Invaders, you know, is pretty openly about McCarthyism and the witch hunt. So like, he was able to, like, having all that experience working in television allowed him to bring an organization to these scripts that he was then applying exploitation techniques when he became a director to bring to life.
Yeah.
Which I think is where the dichotomy of like order versus chaos in his filmography really kind of comes out.
Well, and it is interesting, because I liked your earlier point about how he is, even from a structural standpoint, he's kind of like right in the middle for what you and I both love. You love a wildness and a weirdness and a looseness, and I love a good structure. But it's kind of the best of both worlds, because he gives you that feeling of anything could happen, but it's so well thought out. It's so satisfying narratively.
And there's always a central idea.
Yeah.
Because when I talk to him,
what if kind of, yeah.
He went into pretty heavy detail about how like he was the king of the pitch.
Yeah.
To where like he would just have a central image or a central idea when he would go pitch producers, both for television, and he learned it from pitching shows like to networks, is that, you know, he would go in there and be like, okay, it's about alien invaders, but it's actually really about American McCarthyism. And they'd be like, okay, tell me more. And he told me there would be times where like he would just have meetings with producers or whatever, and like didn't actually have a straight up pitch, and he would look at like a magazine or something in the waiting room and be like, huh, you know what? What if there is a JFK conspiracy? How can I spin that into like an exploitation movie?
Yeah. You know? No, and he's so good at it. And you also have, even the way he worked was, and I watched the King Cohen doc, right? And he hated working in the system. Like, TV kind of broke his heart.
Time and again. It's very Lynchian in the same way of like how they kept, he would keep working inside of the system and then like break away from it as soon as like they would break his heart.
Well, yeah, I mean, and not to skip ahead, but the story behind It's Alive was it was done in 73, and it was the same year as Exorcist, and it was the same company, Warner Brothers, but they didn't want to put it out. They thought it was in bad taste. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You guys just like had one of the biggest blockbusters of all time, one of the original blockbusters, Exorcist. And it didn't come out till 74. Like, they didn't have faith in it. And that was one of his studio films. He loved working. He loved working on his own and being his own producer, because all the stories in the doc of every time he didn't finish a film or another one, he got kicked off a film, was him working with a company. that right. It was not Larco, one of it, you know, and he lost control.
Well, and I think that's where a lot of his like relationship with Bill Lustig formed too, yeah. is they're very much kindred spirits.
Yeah.
And that there's that New York City outlawness to like the way they want to make these movies. Is they don't give a shit about permits, and they don't like, they're not going to have people extra sign releases, all these things that the bureaucracy that like studios get hung up on. Like you can watch, you know, and God Told Me To, and there's all those street scenes and stuff where like Tony LoBianco is just in like Times Square and down like in with the actual people. And the people are looking at the camera, like as the camera's handheld and passing them, because it's clear that they were just like, all right, Tony, you're going to go to that point. This is like the point of the scene. Just kind of go. And then like a cameraman would follow them, and you see like the passerbys in New York City kind of like looking and like doing that like side eye thing of like, why is that guy got a fucking camera? But he's just like, just run with it, man. Because he's like, he really revolutionized, even beyond the new Hollywood stuff, this style of like guerrilla exploitation filmmaking outside of the American system.
No, he's crazy, because you're talking about a lot of these street scenes in particular in a lot of films, like even films that he helped produce and wrote, like, you know, Maniac Cop, you know, is he would do stuff like, I'm going to go film during a police parade. I mean, he's like, I'm going to go into the lion's den of the people who are going to catch you for not having a permit. But he had the great point in the documentary. He's like, if you're making a movie, people assume you're supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Like there's, he knew
that you've got all the T's crossed and the I's dotted. And otherwise, like, oh, yeah, it's fine.
You wouldn't be crazy enough to do it, you know? And, but we were talking offline too of, you know, the line between the, first of all, the fact that no one ever died on one of his films is a miracle. Like, it, and I'm not trying to speak ill, but like, when we compare it to other filmmakers who are working on Hollywood stuff where people were sadly killed because of negligence, mm-hmm. and breaking of like union laws and filmmaking rules.
There were no rules on Larry Cohen's sets.
Well, that's the thing. And he, you know, one of my favorite stories he talked about, you know, we talk about specifically the early like black exploitation, like Black Caesar and Hell Comes to Harlem, Help in Harlem. And one of the funniest parts of the doc is you hear this like back and forth of separate interviews between Fred Williamson and Cohen. And like Cohen also is kind of a print the legend kind of guy, it seems. So he's telling these stories, and Fred Williamson is very much like, that didn't fucking happen. And the story that Cohen would say was, all right, Fred, I need you to roll out of this taxi when it's going at full speed. But anything I ask you to do is I'll do first. So the story he would always tell is like, I won't ask anyone to do anything I wouldn't do first.
Yeah.
And Williams is like, that's a bunch of bullshit. Like that, that never happened.
But he also helped make Fred Williamson a huge star, because Black Caesar was a massive hit.
Yeah.
And honestly, like for my money, behind Truck Turner, possibly the greatest blaxploitation movie ever made.
Well, Jim Brown does the fucking soundtrack. I mean,
yeah, James
Pay Brown the Cost to Be the Boss.
Like. Yeah, well, and then they reject the soundtrack for Hell Up in Harlem and get a more generic kind of blaxploitation funk soundtrack. And like, you can tell the difference between the two movies. That vibe is just not there. But I mean, like, Black Caesar is basically, it was written and promoted as like a blaxploitation response to The Godfather.
Yeah.
But it's really Goodfellas. Yeah. Like it tracks.
Or a Public Enemy kind of.
Yeah.
Like it, Cagney kind of thing.
Yeah. Which traces back to like Cohen loved like the 30s, 40s, like film noir, gangster movies, Scarface, yeah. James Cagney, White Heat, like all that stuff. Like, yep. He incorporates that into Black Caesar, but he also loved like old school monster movies and like beast, you know, movies like sci-fi and stuff, which is where like Cue the Winged Serpent, It's Alive, The Stuff all comes from and is indebted to. But like when you watch Black Caesar, you know, and if you had like already seen Goodfellas, like you're like, there's no way Scorsese has not seen this movie. Like the font is almost the same. Like it has a very similar structure of like, we're going to watch this kid rise up from the streets, take power, and then have like a downfall by the end. It even has like a whole shoeshine joke involving a character named Tommy. And it's like, And that awesome like set piece at the end where he has he you know has the white police captain rival like shine his shoes. Like it's that movie is so good and so loaded and has like such a movie star performance from Fred Williamson. I think not to step on our questions and stuff too early, but like I think that's my pick for his best film, like just all around. Like it's just, it's so complete. It's such a unified kind of statement. And it's just so wildly entertaining as like a work of like gangster cinema that it just, it fires on all cylinders for me.
Well, it's really interesting to see because Scorsese's in the documentary being interviewed and obviously they knew each other, especially because mm-hmm. they're Bernard Herrmann connection. But it's so fascinating to just to look at both these guys from very similar backgrounds, you
right.
know, and both like, I mean, God Told Me To is really, well, he's a Jewish filmmaker. It's about the Catholic faith, which obviously is a really important part of Scorsese's filmography. But also, like, the shooting in New York, the mean streets, the taxi driver feel. It's like they're both really in that specific time period of that 42nd Street.
They're time capsules.
Yeah, they're both working, but they're both attacking from really different directions.
Well, you know? I would also argue that God Told Me To is much about just faith in general.
Right.
Once you get down to it, and just like one specific faith in the Catholic Church, but like it's again, it's about fearing these institutions and also how like when a certain strain or like level of belief infects are like halls of power, because that's the other thing too, is that he's not afraid to get almost like Dickensian with it, to where like you trace it down from like the lowest level scumbag like Michael Moriarty in Cue the Winged Serpent all the way up to like the mayor and police captains and like how these conspiracies and cabals like involve them too.
Yeah,
but like Hell Up in Harlem, for as good as Black Caesar is, Hell Up in Harlem, I think, is his worst movie.
Yeah.
Because you can kind of tell it's slapped together.
It's the same year.
Yeah, it's the same year. It's slapped together. Even Cohen, like, in retrospectives, basically said, like, I didn't really have a script down for it. They just, Black Caesar made all this money. AIP wanted a sequel, like, right away. He kind of tried to make it into, like, The Godfather 2. But it's also, like, because it's, like, the downfall side to where, like, Godfather 1 is Michael Corleone's rise to power. Godfather 2 is purely like right. the downfall and what happens when power goes to your head. That's very much Hell Up in Harlem, you know, especially with like the relationship with like Fred Williamson and the guy who, you know, and Tommy and his dad and yeah. like how he gives power to his dad while he's away in L.A. But you find out about the production behind the scenes is that like Fred Williamson's not in the majority of the movie. It's a body double. Cohen literally writes in a reason to go to L.A. because that's where Fred Williamson was so that he could shoot any interiors with his actual actor. And then, like, there's just huge chunks of the movie that are about a power struggle to keep Tommy's empire alive in New York City while he's gone. But, like, it doesn't actually involve the characters, and you're just watching it, and it's just, like, it becomes one exploitation action set piece after another until it ends. And it's just... it's a real mess, and especially from a guy who, like, has such a firm grasp on, like, story and structure and storytelling itself. Like, it's a misfire, and it's a shame.
Yeah. Well, the next one is It's Alive.
Yeah.
So it's – and it's interesting because he has – you know, that's Warner Brothers, and all three of them are Warner Brothers releases of that trilogy.
Well, he kind of graduates a bit.
Yeah, and, like, and he – it's funny because he was – again, like a Scorsese, or now a Tarantino, of there's all these older actors or composers or cinematographers and producers and all these people who just no one's calling. Like, they're not picking. And he would say, well, what about this guy? You know?
Yeah.
And so he'd give them. And Bernard Herrmann was one of those people who was still working, but he, Scorsese used him on Taxi Driver, he used him on It's Alive, and it really elevates the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really amazing score. And supposedly they became very, very close. And again, to your story, like, supposedly he's a very nice person, Larry Cohen, and we had real relationships with people. Like, we mm-hmm. really hit it off. And
Well, he's an incredible you can tell he has like a producer's mentality.
Right.
Of like
getting a stable together.
Yeah, you know, getting a stable together, using the same actors and below the line people time and again, but also just like, you know, the majority of times getting stuff done is just like getting to know people and getting people on your side and believing in your cause. And the easiest way to do that is to just be cool with people.
Well, you know, with It's Alive, I think, you know, he doesn't use John P. Ryan a lot, but you have John P. Ryan playing the father figure, and you see another side of Larry Cohen. He's really good with actors and with intense actors. And we'll get to that later with Moriarty, Michael Moriarty, a constant collaborator. But in this one, you could see that he really, A, writes very kind of idiosyncratic characters, but also gives these actors room to play. Like, he's driving his wife to have the baby. It's just, he's happy. They're super excited. Had their son in the car. And he's doing a Walter Brennan impersonation as he drives. And it's just really funny and weird and real. And then John P. Ryan for the rest of the film is like harried. He is so fucked up in this movie. And like, he carries the whole feel of, again, this institution that has fallen apart, because the whole beginning part is beautiful. And it's like, oh my God, honey, today's the day I'm going into labor. And it's like all the hope you have and the excitement. And we're going to drop the kid off. He's going to have waffles with basically his uncle. And they're going to have all these stories to tell that the morning. The
child then was, your baby is a literal monster.
And then it just goes fucking haywire. And you have this whole idea of like, I have to be the one to kill it. I'm the father. It's my responsibility to kill this thing. And like, but you see it with his other, he's so good with certain actors and he lets them play, and you see it all the way up to like, you know, Eric Roberts in An Ambulance, of like, I've never seen Eric Roberts so likable and so amazing. You know,
he also has like, his protagonists are never like a doctor or a cop.
Yeah. Or a writer.
Like, they're pretty like weird, idiosyncratic, and oftentimes creative like people. Mm-hmm. So we're like Michael Moriarty playing the piano in Cue the Winged Serpent, and he's just a small time crook. Eric Roberts is a cartoonist.
Who works with Stan Lee.
Now, and God told me to, that's the rare exception to the rule, because Tony LoBianco is a detective investigating, you know, these random shootings and acts of violence that are occurring around the city, and they all end with the simple phrase, God told me to. That's they're all asked, why did you do this? It's like, it starts with a guy literally up on a tower, you know, shooting people on the street, and it's a pretty intense, harrowing sequence.
Yes.
And then Tony LoBianco climbs all the way up to the top of the tower and, you know, is trying to talk him down and ask him. He's like, oh, well, why did you do this? And he's like, God told me to. And then it becomes about his investigation into the connection between all these crimes and these people. And it reveals there's always a greater conspiracy inside of the Larry Cohen movies that ends up revealing itself. Like, Ambulance becomes this like cabal started by a doctor who wants to go outside of the system, and like God Told Me To becomes a religious cult, but that also is powered by aliens. That is the craziest turns out of all of them.
I mean, I loved this movie. Like, this was another, we were talking, you asked last week, like, what were your favorite first watches so far in 2026? And this was another, actually a lot of the films I watched for this podcast are right up in that group, because I've honestly really enjoyed all of them. And this one, though, because you know I love a good horror mythology.
Yeah.
And I love the mythology of this movie. Like, I love, like, it keeps going and going. And we talked about this with Clive Barker, the layers of horror, the layers of mythology you have. Okay, what if Uncle Frank came back? We also have Cenobites below that who are coming for him. There's these layers of worse and worse and worse and darker and meaner. And this feels like that as well, where you're like, well, and also you wrap up your protagonist. It's very noir in that sense, right? Of like, of, oh my God, I'm also part of this mystery that I'm trying to solve.
Yeah, it's the whole like, you know, Shane Black thing of like, we're going to introduce one person's storyline and then another person's storyline. And inevitably, in true noir fashion,
it's the same mystery.
In the old Johnny Gossamer books, they always collide with one another.
That's a really good comparison. And this film, too, LoBianco is amazing. He's really good. And I've always liked him. He's got a great face. I mean, obviously, French Connection and other
Seven Ups.
He is so good in this movie. And because he really, like, I love that it's this really weird backstory of he's been married. He's still married, but he doesn't want a divorce. He doesn't want his current girlfriend to know he doesn't want, because he knows he can't have children for some reason.
Yeah.
And you don't know why. And
it becomes an integral to the actual, like, mystery.
This was just a full rabbit hole movie where I was just like, where is this fucking going?
Also, like, his girlfriend, like, Larry Cohen, great taste in women. Fucking gold wire rim glasses. Like, she is a fucking smoke show.
Yeah, and his wife is, like, this weird, like, super Catholic.
Well, there's a lot of, like, you can tell Larry Cohen didn't really believe in marriage too much. Like,
right.
A lot of his, the wives, like, starting with Bone, are, like, these kind of weird put upon harpies.
Yeah, you know? They're shrill.
They're very shrill. But at the same time, he has empathy for them because, like, you know, in Bone, that you find out why she's so shrill and put upon and miserable is because it's usually the guys don't get off light. They're all fucking shit heels and flawed too.
Right. Yeah. It's again, even the institution of marriage,
right,
is not safe. But yeah, God told me to. Oh my God, I love this movie. It's one of those movies I'm like, why did I take so long to get to it? It's so good.
And once you do, you're just kind of like, it's one of the, like, ultimate New York movies too. Like,
oh,
it's,
my God.
Along with, like, the Abel Ferrara movies and the Martin Scorsese movies, is that you can look at a Larry Cohen movie or the Bill Lustig movies, like, that they made together. Like, you can look at them and get a snapshot of, like, if you want to see 70s New York, Larry Cohen and Martin Scorsese, some of the very best. If you want to watch 80s New York, I would do probably Bill Lustig and Abel Ferrara, and then Ferrara up through the 90s, especially with, like, something like Bad Lieutenant, you know? Like, if you watched a bunch of those
King
movies,
of New York, yeah.
Yeah, you can see the city kind of evolve before your eyes and all of these fictional narratives about it.
Hell yeah.
And, I mean, which brings me to, I mean, my personal, well, Black Caesar's the best. I think, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's definitely the one I've watched the most is Cue the Winged Serpent.
I love this movie
because it's so bizarre. It has such a stacked cast in hindsight. I mean, it's Michael Moriarty, his first team up with Larry Cohen. Like, he has this almost like bio-digital jazz thing he's doing the entire time. Yes. He's so twitchy and weird. And he is, like, one of the ultimate, like, Cohen performers because he's, like, you can tell that, like, and he's notoriously difficult. Like, everybody's kind of noted all the way up to, like, you know, he walked off of Law and Order. He was one of the original casts of that show and walked off because he, quote unquote, got bored with it. And it was like, you walked away from, like, one of the biggest paychecks of at all time, you know? But it's like,
he likes to play.
He likes to play. He likes to fuck around. And so does Larry Cohen. Larry Cohen indulges these people. I mean, again, stretching all the way back to Bone, like, Yaphet Kotto in that is doing all kinds of wild actorly stuff that you can tell Cohen was just like, yeah, we're just going to roll it and you just play the scene how you want. Like, give me something that's interesting and unique. And then you marry that with a lot of the street level New York photography, but then you throw in David Carradine as a cop, Richard Roundtree as a higher up inside of the New York Police Department. You have this incredible stop motion
Candy Clark dragon. As the girlfriend.
Candy Clark as the girlfriend.
She's amazing.
Like, it's so good. And, like, again, it's a genre splatter painting to where it's like, okay, well, what if it's like an American kind of like kaiju movie, but it's also kind of like this low level crime film where Michael Moriarty's character is like this kind of aspiring. He's an ailing and an addict in recovery.
Yep.
And he's also an aspiring pianist who really doesn't want to release an album. He's not like a genius. He just basically wants a steady job in a bar playing piano and singing his weird, like, bebop songs. And then it becomes like a relationship drama with him and Candy Clark for a minute. It's just, and then it becomes this movie again about a cult that stretches all the way up through the levels of power inside of New York City that pray to a Mayan god called Quetzalcoatl.
It's Quetzalcoatl.
Is the winged serpent, but it's a bird too. And it has that amazing shootout at the end where all the cops start shooting at the flying dragon. Like, this movie is insane. I couldn't imagine what it would have been like to see this in theaters when it was first released.
It well, and I remember the first time I saw it, I liked it, but again, I hadn't quite figured out Larry Cohen. Again,
this was an Exhumed classic. I've seen this on 35 a couple times.
Well, you were saying earlier about like the feature versus the bug, right? And right. Moriarty, you have to kind of get on his wavelength too. And once you do, you're like, oh my God, this is like so interesting because, to your point too, it is this like, it's a mashup of a lot of stuff. But from the first time you see Moriarty, he's at this dim sum place with these other guys. They're going to rob a jewelry place. Like a Tiffany's.
It's almost like this scene, the opening scene from Reservoir Dogs.
100%. But he's so fucking funny and alive,
like, and
he's
twitchy.
He's crackling, and they're like, hey, don't eat all the cashew chicken. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you had some already. It's like the writing's also like just impeccable. Like,
yeah,
Larry Cohen now, because I'm, you know, working on rewrites for my script, and I'm like, this guy is someone I need to rewatch a lot of stuff because the way his scenes move. And it's funny the way that we missed the joke with Branded is, that was a reference to him. You had told me, and also in the documentary, that Big Lebowski, the whole scene, they go and see little Larry and Larry's father. That's supposed to be Larry Cohen in the Iron Lung. It's a tribute to him.
The bulk of the series,
the
dude.
Way the Coens write their comedy scenes is
bulk
not
the series.
Is bulk of the series. And a good day to you too, sir. But the way they write their comedy scenes, the way they twist and turn is very similar to Larry Cohen.
Yeah.
There's a surprising nature. They're also very structured writers, but there's a wildness and an idiosyncratic nature to their scenes.
Well, the Coens do something similar to Larry Cohen, too, is that they take something, particularly with, like, Big Lebowski's actually a great example of, is that they're like, what if we took a Raymond Chandler noir, but, like, the mystery doesn't really matter. It's just about these two stoners, and they transmute film noir into their own version of like a stoner comedy too, and just kind of like pickpocket all these things and then display them to where it's like, and you have Sam Elliott as this weird narrator, and then you have these colorful characters that keep popping up, like, you know, the Jesus, this pedophile bowler. I mean, the other one that I think of too is The Man Who Wasn't There with Billy Bob Thornton. It's very Larry Cohen-y, to where it's almost like, what if we took this like mashup of, again, like a black and white film noir with like a 50s sci-fi movie, and also about just this lonely dude like trying to make sense of the world. Like, they're all, I think it's no coincidence that, like, they all kind of share this very distinct perspective and almost like borderline nihilistic view of the world, of kind of like, it's all fucked up, so you sort of just have to laugh at it and find a way to exploit it to your own gain.
Yes, no, 100%. And just like, again, just the surprising nature of their narratives, and just the scene at the scene level.
Yeah,
you know,
there's a spontaneity to it.
That's and the way they work with actors too. It just really crackles, and finding the right people, the Steve Buscemi's, you know, could be like a Moriarty. The way that they know how to work with these people,
or even something as simple as like John Goodman, and being like, well, what if he kind of looked like John Milius? You know what I mean?
Right.
And, like, talked like him and everything. Just weird little in-references the entire time. It's like having red buttons in the ambulance.
He's one of the best parts of that movie.
And you sit there, and he's almost playing, like, Studs Terkel. Like, this Dollar General Studs Terkel. And you're like, what the fuck is going on here? And the movie becomes just as much about him as it does Eric Roberts', you know, quest to find this girl that he falls in love with on the street, and this weird ambulance that, like, whisked her away.
Well, and that is another thing we don't want to forget with the way he structures his films is, he likes to make these little duos, and often many of them in one film.
Yeah.
It's very episodic in that sense of, like, our hero will meet someone and all of a sudden they're partners for a while. And
so
then it goes from there to there.
I had some thoughts about that too, is I wonder how much of that is like, again, being a New Yorker and being a people watcher and assigning, like, you have to imagine, even like when he was young and stuff, like, I wonder if Larry Cohen was one of those types who sat on like a park bench and assigned a backstory to everybody who passed him and was like, I wonder what's going on in that person's life, and then imagined it. And if he couldn't imagine it, just assigned them, well, like, whatever he thought was happening. Because again, it goes with the whole, like, you know, the city is like a million stories thing,
right?
A million movies happening at once is because everybody's the protagonist in their own film.
Yeah.
And like, he really kind of buys into that idea. So like, I think that's where a lot of his idiosyncratic kind of leading characters come from, is just because he doesn't find like the average person like that interesting.
No. And you have a someone,
or I guess I shouldn't say average person, but like, the average, like, narrative protagonist, again, is that interesting.
The cop, the doctor, the writer, the
strong, like, Campbellian hero is never going to be a Larry Cohen protag.
Well, yeah, no, because you have, I mean, like, Moriarty is the definition in Q of, you know, he's a heel, too. Like, he's not a good boyfriend. He's not a good criminal. Like, he kind of, he's
not even a good piano player, like either. Like, his song kind of sucks.
Well, and that's the funny thing, too, is you have that scene, and obviously, he is a jazz musician in real life and a pianist that Larry Cohen said, well,
shocker.
We might as well put it in there, right? And, but it's funny because that scene is, it almost has the sense of, he's like, if I get this job, I'm not going to go do the crime. Because he kind of comes in, like, and his girlfriend's giving him the opportunity. And then he's like, well, I got another job anyway. It's kind of like, he's like, ah, fuck it. You know, yeah. I didn't think I was going to make it anyway.
Very living life by the seat of his pants and just hustling from one gig to the next.
Well, and that's what's so great about this movie. And a lot of is, again, that spontaneity is, you have this character who's just doing whatever he can, kind of like a Safdie lead, right? We've talked about that as well.
Oh, yeah.
Who will do whatever he can, throw whoever he has to under the bus to get ahead. Like, it's very good times as well. Just like, I will lie to my girlfriend. I'll do this. I'll use whoever I can. And because you have this monster, you know, this beast that is just going to kill who it's going to kill. And obviously you have the cabal that's like kind of controlling it in some kind of way. But you have our main character says, oh, I found this giant nest at the top of the Chrysler building. And he is like now being hunted by criminals that he worked with. And he did lose the money that they stole. And they're like, well, we're going to kill you if you don't find it. He goes, oh, actually, it's up here. Mm-hmm. So he's using the monster.
It's about exploitation.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to use that to get ahead or just basically survive. And you have that wonderful scene where he's trying to get his $1 million because he knows where the monster lives. And he goes to the seat of power in New York and like the mayor and everyone. And it's this great fucking scene where he's like, you owe me. Like, this city owes me for like a cop like you. You know, put a finger on me and, you know, fingered me. And then I was in state race, almost like a Michael Mann character, almost like Thief, right? Like institutionally raised.
Yeah, very much also like, and also aware of the fact that like the city has had its hands in his pocket the entire time. And now it's time for them to pay him back.
Yes. It's almost like a Jim Thompson character in a way. It has that real...
Well, it's the noir thing.
Yeah, that really...
And also, like, he's not afraid, like you said, to make them unlikable.
Oh.
Like, he's kind of a heel. He's kind of weird. You know, he doesn't seem like he would be that much fun to hang out with. But he also... He continues doing this and even takes the unlikability into greater... to greater lengths, we should say, with like movies like special effects in the 80s and stuff.
Yes.
When he starts making these New York films that with this kind of troupe of folks from like the kind of off-Broadway art scene with, you know, Brad Rajin, Eric Bogosian,
playwright,
you know, who's a playwright and who had been writing like Suburbia and stuff at the time.
Yeah.
And then
and talk radio right around then too.
Yeah. Yep. Talk radio. He's on the cusp of like exploding. And then Zoe Lund, or who's Zoe Tamerlis, you know, is billed in this movie, who had made, you know, Miss 45 with Abel Ferrara.
Who is this muse for a lot of these filmmakers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can tell why, is because like she's smoking hot in this movie
and
in that very heroin chic sort of way.
It's kind of sad, honestly, to watch, just knowing her story.
Yeah, it ends very, very miserably, we'll say. But that movie is a, you know, talk about like an unlikable protagonist. It's about a filmmaker who's basically a pervert who kills a girl on camera and then uses it because he's failing. His career's dying. He's a huge fuck up. He's been fired from the last couple movies because they keep losing money, which frankly, bit of autobiography kind of filtered through this scumbag. And you can see Cohen almost like identifying with this guy a little bit, but also like, so he kills this girl, and to cobble a movie together, he uses the real footage from the murder and then tries to continue making a narrative film about it afterwards. It's almost like it's like a cross between it. It is like Larry Cohen's like Brian De Palma movie for me. 100%. It's very much like his body double or his blowout at the same time.
Well, it's so a you movie. Like, I knew you already told me you liked it. I had never seen it till this go through.
It opens with Zoe Lund on roller skates and firecracklers topless, like skating around the set and like completely naked, and the camera just swinging around with her. And like from that moment forward, I was like, yep, into this.
It's one of his trashier movies.
Oh, it's very, very sleazy.
It's like, and I really liked it, but Bogosian is weird as fuck in it.
But also was apparently written in the 60s. It was one of the earliest scripts that he ever wrote, because with that opening monologue, you know, it's over black and the credits are rolling, and it's a interview with Bogosian after his latest film has failed, and he's being a real dick, and they ask him what his greatest influence is, and he says Abraham Zapruder. And they go, how do you spell that? JFK. And that's what the movie is inspired by, is the Zapruder film, and the idea that like you can cobble together any narrative
around
from like this footage of a real killing if you really want to, and then create your own conspiracy out of it. It's very much born out of like that post JFK kind of like paranoia.
You know, it just doesn't have, I really liked it, but you know why De Palma is able to do this kind of story so much more effectively. Like, I feel like I like it a lot, but it's messier than if De Palma had done it. I think the lack of formalism maybe hurts it.
The other thing too is that where De Palma's movies are sleazy, they're rarely ugly. Like, He loves photographing like beautiful women, and they're very artificial, and you get lost inside of like this beautiful kind of cinematic artifice to it. There's almost special effects is interesting because it's a movie about artifice and about the craft of filmmaking and turning a real life tragedy into art, but it's not beautiful. It's pretty grimy and ugly, and it gets you inside of these like apartments and lofts, and it's on these snowy, wet, gross New York streets like during winter, and it just, there's no artifice to get lost in. It's, you're getting more lost in the scumminess of this director's existence.
That's fair. Yeah.
And then he also makes, at the same time with the same group of actors, a movie called Perfect Strangers, which Vinegar Syndrome put out some time ago on Blu-ray, that I think is one of the when you watch them as a duology, they're kind of an undervalued duo inside of Cohen's filmography. And I know Special Effects is one of Cohen's like favorite movies that he made. He told me when I talked to him. But Perfect Strangers is, you know, Brad Dragin, who is the kind of like corn poke husband of Zoe Tamaris in Special Effects. He's a hitman who a kid witnesses his latest murder, and he goes and tries to seduce the kid's mom in order to kill the only witness, you know, and rub them out. And it's a neat little weird romantic thriller thing, but it's also similarly like grimy and New York and very lo-fi and low budget, and just kind of gets you in to all those places the same way that Special Effects does.
There's something I really like about his films too, and I mean this is a compliment to him, is there's sometimes they feel kind of slight, like a cool programmer.
Yeah.
Like at their worst, you know, because he was so prolific as a writer that he had just these like roll it. He just had these file systems of hundreds of scripts.
Yeah, because he would get up every day, and he was one of those guys who would just write. And
he
just
has
write and write.
And I guess
kind of like Stephen King.
Like Stephen King, but yeah, he has the feel of an 80s paperback novelist.
Yeah,
like a horror novelist. Even not even a Stephen King, like a Dean Koontz, who's just pumping out.
Yeah.
You know, but a lot of they're all really good.
Insulting, by the way, but okay.
No, but I mean in terms of even more prolific, just like
he's better looking than Dean Koontz. Definitely had better hair.
Oh my God, Jesus Christ. But then you get to The Stuff, which is another one of my favorites.
One of his biggest hits.
And also, I mean, watching the documentary and you watch the film too, is it required a lot of the most pre-planning, which he was kind of usually against. He was a very like fly by the seat of his pants filmmaker. They had to like do a lot more production design.
The narrative has the same kind of spontaneity as his other movies, but yeah, it feels different because it's almost like his 50s sci-fi
yes.
homage to The Blob,
yeah.
But it's also a takedown of American consumerism and junk food.
Well, it's weirdly, it would pair really well with Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Yeah, really well.
Very, very similar idea of this like small town or these like, this mysterious factory that's making something. There's what are they putting in it? Where does it come from? What's the secret sauce kind of thing?
Well, and also so many of Coen's movies never ventured out in New York City. That's what feels visually different about the
right.
stuff is you get Larry Coen shooting suburbia. You get him out in the mountains and stuff. You
yeah.
get all
pastoral
the
America,
the
yeah.
military stuff. He gets to kind of travel around America while still coming back to New York City at certain points with Michael Moriarty. Also one of Michael Moriarty's best, like, because he's like a corporate hatchet man.
He's a corporate espionage. He goes in and supposed to like find the secret sauce, but he would be, you know, the guy who'd find out Coca-Cola or like the spices used in KFC
yeah.
and then sell it to the competitor.
Yeah.
Like what is the stuff?
And he's continuously kind of infiltrating this world, but like this also like all the bright colors of like the purples and stuff of like what the stuff is packaged inside of the commercial that's kind of smack dab in the middle of the movie, like it's very like it's bright and poppy in a way that a lot of his films hadn't been to that point, which I think is why it's probably one of his biggest crossovers.
It almost has the sense of humor of a Joe Dante movie.
Yeah, very. That's a good comparison.
Very,
I hadn't thought of that.
Very bubblegummy, purposely, and like you said, the 1950s, like Matinee would pair well with this. That really like that era,
while still retaining that very bleak, venomous streak. Like it ending with you know the stuff more or less being destroyed and outlawed, and then becoming like crack cocaine to where people are dealing it on the streets at the end. Like it's pretty weird to where it's again Coen being like, yeah, all the stuff that like these big corporations and things try to sell you, not only is it going to kill you when you outlaw it, the black market's going to bring it back and it's going to kill you again.
Yeah, it's very cynical, very nihilistic view of you can't beat it.
Yeah,
you know,
you got to join it.
You can join it. And but again, another Moriarty performance of you first meet him and he gets on this this big yacht, and I don't know this improv, but he grabs this guy's hand. That's a sweaty palm.
Yeah,
that's sweaty palm too. It's so fucking
funny.
He's
also like he sings to himself in certain scenes too, which he does in Cue the Winged Serpent.
It's so weird.
Like I have to imagine they had a great collaboration, but if you're thinking about it, if you were the director on any kind of technical level, I also you can see why Michael Moriarty drove people insane.
Oh yeah,
is because if you're shooting it and he just starts doing that shit and it's not what you want, you're like, what are you doing? Like you're cut, Michael. What the fuck is
like a Crispin Glover kind of thing?
Why are you singing jazz here? I don't know. I thought it'd be cool. I don't think it's cool.
Yeah,
I can't use that take now. like, fuck off, man.
It's almost like he's the actor version of Terrence Malick.
Yeah.
Where it's like, ooh, look at that over there.
You know? Bird.
It's like, oh, look at that beautiful sunset.
You think that bird looks like Jesus?
But
a bird looks like Ben Affleck.
But you white, you Ben Affleck. But it's something about, you also have, again, this kind of like lining up of duos. Like he meets, you know, Garrett Morris and they work together for a little bit. And then, you know, he meets this reporter and then the kid gets involved and they all are now. And then he gets to meet a wonderful Paul Sorvino is basically,
oh my God, he's so funny in this movie.
What if Alex Jones had his own private military?
Yeah.
It's like, it's literally like they're putting stuff in the water to mind control people. But it's like, we have to use this guy because the real military won't do it.
Sorvino also commits to the bit.
Oh my God.
So hard. That's the other thing too, is that like, even these guys that he only got on set for a couple days, like what you could tell that he was like, he would probably sell them on the fact of like, look, this is your character. You can do whatever you want. I don't give a shit. Like, as long as it's cool and I think it's funny, like, I'm just going to let you, because Sorvino's weird deadpan energy the entire time, or every line he says is funny because it's just because he's so stern. He's so authoritarian. And the way he just delivers certain things and like looks at you like he's going to kill you the entire time. You're just like, it's almost like, what if Paulie was funny? You know what I mean?
Well, it's the same. He honestly does the same bit. He uses it in The Rocketeer. Where he's the whole end, he's like, I may not make an honest buck, but I'm 100% American, and grabs the machine gun. It's that very like
deadpan,
stone cold, like gangster, but also like it's funny as hell.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. But he would also have guys like James Dixon. He always found weird roles who kind of looked like Larry Cohen. It was weird. You almost wonder.
Wait, is that that?
He's the flabby white Irish kind of cop with the big chubby cheeks.
Jughead?
Yeah, Jughead.
That's his best friend from growing up.
Yeah.
They grew up together.
They look identical.
It's so crazy.
And like, but he's in every movie.
Yeah.
And it's just like, but he always finds a role for James Dixon to do, and he finds something goofy for him to do every time. The whole like running Jughead thing. Like, it's another great example. Not only him, but like James Earl Jones in The Ambulance is one of the strangest fucking performances I've ever seen in my life.
The gum.
He's just in his own movie when he's, yeah, he bites the gum. The fucking, when he just yells at everyone, the whole scene where he just yells at like his secretary and like berates her and then winks almost like this is a thing that they do every day. And you're like, what the fuck was that? And then he just vanishes from the film. It's clear that he only had like 4 or 5 days with him or whatever. And I was like, yeah, James, you could, Darth Vader, do whatever the fuck you want, but like just make it funny.
He gets killed. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like almost off screen.
Right. He gets stabbed in the heart or I something. Think,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, because it's funny because there's that.
It's the only thing about that movie is that it's so breakneck that I lost like track of certain things while it's happening.
It is. That movie is bonkers. And we were talking offline too. I mean, it is existing in the same world as Maniac Cop. It's this comic book world. While it is the street level thing, it's so pulpy. Even for Cohen.
Well, it also has that, like, look, Ma, no hands sense of, like, stunt coordination with, I think it's Spiro Zadas, again, yeah. who did the stunt coordination on the Maniac Cop films, notably Maniac Cop 2, where it becomes almost like a Hong Kong shoot 'em up movie, and they're doing, like, fucking wire work in that film.
He did,
like,
he did Shakedown, too, for Glickenhaus.
Yeah, he did a lot of those. So, like, but it had, that's actually a good comparison, too, is that, like, it has that unhinged, you know, we're doing this with no guardrails. Like, somebody could fucking die. Like, that whole scene where they shoot the stretcher out of the back of the ambulance and Eric Roberts is strapped to it and it's just going through traffic. I'm watching it like, this is like a Jackass stunt to where it could go so horribly wrong so fast.
Well, it was so funny where their ambulance is at one point in this this club. And it's on almost like a ramp, like it's there as like a piece of the decoration, right?
Right.
But you know it's the ambulance. And there's this big glass wall behind it. I turned to Val, I go, they're gonna bust through that wall.
Yeah.
And it was just like he has this great way of setting up also like the joke.
Yeah.
And you know it's Larry Cohen. It's like, even if he doesn't have the budget, they're gonna drive through that glass wall.
He's gonna find a way to break it. Like, there's gonna be a thing and he's gonna capture it on film and it's gonna be so thrilling. Like that scene where the ambulance drives through the club and just smashes everything up. That's also straight out of Maniac Cop.
Well, literally it has the same stunt where it goes through that brick wall and then Eric Robert grabs the wire. It's what happens with Bruce Campbell in Maniac Cop 1, where he spins off the side of the truck when it goes into the water.
And they almost killed that stuntman doing that stunt in the first Maniac Cop.
And like, it looks like it.
Yeah, because it's so dangerous looking. It also has the same kind of, like, when you open the back of the ambulance and like it's glowing green and stuff. It has that same almost like comic booky
anti-reality
that Maniac Cop owns, to where like you can tell like
the little Rossi scenes with the red and his like
exactly
his lair.
Or like in Maniac Cop 3, even though that was technically that Bill Lustig didn't even finish that movie, it still has that very gothic,
yeah,
like foggy, like Bride of Frankenstein kind of feel. Like it, that all the green stuff in the back of the ambulance almost feels pulled from like a modern Hammer movie.
Well, that's the thing we were talking earlier, though. His films were not very produced in terms of like atmosphere. Usually,
yeah.
Ambulance stands out and feels like, if you told me that was directed by Bill Lustig, I wouldn't be surprised. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
I'm not saying he did, but it's like,
or even James Glickenhaus.
I think he learned from working with those guys, and the movie has a certain, like, again, comic booky.
Well, there's also phases too.
Yeah.
To where that was the one thing of watching, we've completely abandoned again our idea that we tried to do last year. We're like, what if we only did like a movie or two per episode? It's like, nah. Fuck that. We're just going to be who we are.
Yes.
But it's like watching these movies, though, in such a condensed kind of burst. And you can see that he had different stylings in different periods. Like the 70s stuff is a lot more jangly and handheld.
Yeah.
He got to the 80s and got a little more controlled, especially with stuff like the stuff and the ambulance. But yeah, like you could tell, like it just kind of was when it was period appropriate, I guess the best way you could put it is that like he evolved with the times too, which probably allowed him to keep making movies.
Well, and I mean, we're going to get to this with a future podcast, but a director like Rennie Harlan too, where it's like, you look at his films and he's a sign of what a film like that looked in that era. Like,
right.
You know, it's like, this is what a thriller, this is what like a crazy MTV looking thing is in 2001.
One that the ambulance has the hot girl from Cliffhanger right before she's in Cliffhanger.
Oh yeah.
She's the girl on the street that he meets at first.
Yeah. Who's also in Monkey Shines.
Right.
She's the girlfriend.
Yeah.
The clinical cunt, as his friend calls her.
So you want to talk about the two that you really didn't like that much? Cause you don't like Return to Salem's Lot. His sort of sequel to the Stephen King story that nobody liked and was kind of buried and hard to see forever.
Yeah, and then the other one will finish.
Original Gangsters.
Yeah, so Return to Salem's Lot is weird. I liked it more this time because, again, my mindset has shifted when it comes to A, Moriarty, and B, Larry Cohen.
Right.
But I just, Salem's Lot's my favorite book, and the Salem's Lot first Toby Hooper version is one of my favorite adaptations to Stephen King. So this movie, it's always felt really, it has a Herschel Gordon Lewis, like 2000 Maniacs feel to it, where you kind of wander around this town and it feels kind of aimless. And
yeah,
the mythology is messy, and even Samuel Fuller, who I like, it's very charming. I'm like,
I was going to say, you do get a classic Larry Cohen idiosyncratic performance in that, though, from Samuel Fuller as a vampire hunter.
Yeah.
But it's also weird, too, because it's almost like vampires as like gentrifiers and suburban
cultists.
Like
he has
cultists,
an idea there for sure.
And Michael Moriarty, again, coming back and infiltrating their own little like cabal that they've built for themselves. But they're also like inviting. Like, I like the idea of, like,
it's almost like Sinners.
Yeah, like, he has this idea about these vampires. Is like, what if these vampires didn't just want to kill us all the time? And we're like, we're good. Like, we just set up our own shit. And, like, you can join if you want, I guess. It's pretty fun. But, like, I like that movie more than you. But I see why. Like, I couldn't imagine what it would have been like if you were a producer. Again, and this is probably where he and Moriarty were kindred spirits, is that, again, is that, like, you asked, and obviously you have to green light this and everything, but, like, return, you're like, we're going to make a Salem's Lot spinoff. We're going to get the Larry Cohen guy. He's pretty good at this shit. And then he turns in that script, and you're like, I guess we're pot committed now. Like, we got to make this thing. And then that first cut of that movie turns back. Like, if I had paid for it, I would sit there and be like, so who's this for? Exactly. My guess is nobody.
But in terms of quality, it's not far off in terms of, like, they're pumping out Stephen King stuff, right? It obviously is not. But you have the graveyard shifts around that era as well.
It looks great.
Yeah, it looks great, and it has that minor feel to it at the same time. Yeah. You know, and I don't hate the movie. It's
it also
just
feels
like
a novella.
It, yeah.
A lot the same way that, like, Graveyard Shift felt, too.
Very short. Very kind of small in terms of scope.
Original Gangsters. You did not like this. Another movie that, again, I think I just having more spent more time with Coen's filmography as I have a bit more of a soft spot for this one. But I'll even admit, it's like, it's almost purely a gimmick movie of like, let's bring all these blaxploitation actors
Expendables.
Back. Yeah, the Expendables of blaxploitation
yeah.
for like the Jackie Brown era.
Yeah, and it's funny. So I don't hate it. I saw it before. That's when I saw when it first came out. Like I remember seeing all the commercials for it. I think my brother and I ran it. It was 96. We would rent everything of that. That kind of almost, and also, oh, that's the guy who was just in Dust Till Dawn kind of thing, right? You know? And watching it again, I mean, watching the documentary, you can, the stories go that he and Williamson at that point were butting heads a lot.
Yeah.
And you could tell because Williamson also, in IMDb at least, gets co-credit as director.
Yeah.
Because he had a lot of ideas. And you could almost see there's two movies there, like Williamson's movie where he's a total badass and Coen where he's kind of taking the piss out of some of it.
Yeah.
And, but it's like, I think Williamson's version is the Expendables version of, hey, we're all back. We got our machine guns.
Yeah. He's approaching it like Sly Stallone.
Yeah, exactly. Of like, I'm going to return to my greatness. We're gonna have fun with it. But Coen, I think, is trying to do something more interesting, but it just doesn't come across. I think the more interesting thing about the film is like where they shot it and the story behind it. From the King Coen doc is they shot in Gary, Indiana, one of the most dangerous murder capital of the world, basically, of America. I grew up not too far from there, and you do not drive.
Are you trying to strip Baltimore of its title?
Well, it's up there.
Okay.
But Gary,
Indiana, the tough streets of Indiana.
Well, it's literally right next to Chicago. It's where all, mm-hmm. you know, it's like right across the water. But
no,
anyway.
It's okay, keep talking.
But they,
East Coast supremacy.
What's interesting about, I mean, Gary,
we're better at murdering people than you.
Well, what's cool inside the film, though, is they, and I think this feels like Coen to me, where you get the whole history of Gary, Indiana, of
yeah,
how it was.
That's
and this,
neat.
And this
that's,
is,
those are the parts that I responded
and
to.
That, and I was like, this is great, because that's like the story I even heard. My dad would be like, he's like, we don't go through Gary. He's like, but he was like, this place was disenfranchised by Reagan. Like,
right.
It was like, he shut down all the mills, he crushed the unions, and then you have 100,000 people out of work.
Well,
and
just,
what's gonna happen then?
There's those types of towns kind of everywhere too. It's like the story of like Youngstown, Ohio.
Yeah, Erie,
like
Pennsylvania has
Erie, Pennsylvania. Yep. Like yeah. He again found this in of like the government's not to be trusted. It leaves the working man behind. It crushes its own cities.
Right.
Now this is basically what happens in the ashes and the aftermath.
Yeah, and you have even the gang culture of like the lies that gangs tell. Like,
yeah.
That's like that you have the grandfather or the father figure to Fred Williamson, who is just sick of these drive-bys, and but he's always been respected by the youth, and they're like, they leave him alone until he's like, well, I'm gonna tell the cops what I saw. You know, it's like you break what's the rules you have to go by, and you have the interesting character of Paul Winfield as the go-between, who's this minister who is kind of gray. He kind of mm-hmm. plays both sides. He's also looking for money.
I'm not going to lie, revisiting this movie did give me an idea for an episode, is that I know you haven't done a whole lot of blaxploitation either, and that could be fun to cherry pick
oh, yeah.
a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen my fair share, but like, there's lots of good stuff out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You want to get to questions?
Well, real quick, do you want to talk about his final directorial project?
Masters of Horror?
His episode, Pick Me Up.
Yeah.
Written by David Chow, great writer, great horror writer and horror short story. And also the screenwriter of The Crow.
Yeah.
And
which that show did a decent amount of too, because like Coscarelli's An Incident On and Off
is Joe Lansdale.
Like you would see a lot of pairings of kind of these old filmmakers with old horror writers too.
And I just wanted to talk about it because Moriarty talks about in the doc, he's like, this is my favorite role I ever did.
Yeah.
Like, at least with Coen. And it is him going all the way. Like, and he even said, and it was cool because, like, Larry Coen talked about how in the past, and working on TV or in back in the 60s and 70s, like as the writer, you'd be invited to set because if you're going to do anything, you need the writer there. And scared the shit out of me. Cat just jumped on me. But he invited David Chow to set. So they were really like riffing, you know, riffing with these scenes. And that episode is just so my shit. And also just very Larry Conan. Like, it's so idiosyncratic. It's so strange. Like, he has, you know.
But also shrunken down. It's him. It's an interesting, like, intersection of his television work and his feature work is that it's a feature shrunken down for television.
Yeah. Which a lot of them are, but you had made the point it's one of the few that feels like a fully realized movie and vision versus, like, I love Cigarette Burns. One of my favorites is, you know, it's Carpenter Cigarette Burns. Great story, super cool, but it feels cheap. It feels like his hands are cuffed with, like, you got about two locations here, man. Like, not a lot of effects.
And as much as I like Incident on or off a Mountain Road, like, it still feels kind of like Coscarelli doing an episode of TV.
Yeah.
The anthology stuff, it's such a neat idea. It just never really formulated. And there's a couple, though. The Mike one that was banned originally from Showtime, or, like, they took it off the air, was really, really good. But then, like, for every good one, there are a couple, like, bad ones.
The Toby Hooper one, I remember sucking. The Dance of the Dead.
Yeah, not great. And then the Argento one's real bad. Jennifer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, with Steven Weber.
He wrote the script.
Yeah, no bueno.
Yeah.
Now you want to get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right.
One. To get down. Paid the cost to be the boss. Paid the cost to be the boss. I paid the cost to be the boss. Look at me. You know what to see.
And we're back with questions about the filmography of Larry Cohen. Martin, since this is your show, top three. What are your finest discoveries?
Not a discovery, but number three would be The Stuff. Actually, no, sorry. Q is my number three. I think Q. I had seen it before, but it clicked with me more this time. Top Moriarty, amazing. Two would be Ambulance. I just, holy fuck, this movie is just, this is a true, like,
it's a lot of fun. I don't like it as much as you do because it's a little too slapdash and comedic at certain points, but it's hard to deny.
Yeah, it's great. And then number one is God Told Me To, like, just full stop. That was just a revelation for me. Like a classic 70s, like, should be in the pantheon, I think, of, like, great 70s horror.
Yeah, it was also one of those movies that back in the day when IFC was an actual channel and would play a lot of horror films, especially around Halloween in the month of October. I saw God Told Me To a few times that way. I would probably go with three is special effects, two, Cue the Winged Serpent, one, Black Caesar.
Yeah. You know? Tracks. Yeah. I think for both our styles.
Yeah. What's the worst one? Sorry, Larry, wherever you are. I mean,
Help in Harlem, I think, is.
Yeah, it's really, such a mess.
It's really messy.
An Original Gangsters, maybe after that.
Yeah. It's funny. The films that. These are films that aren't wholly him, right? You have the rushed nature of Help in Harlem.
Yeah.
And you have the late era.
Was Gangsters a Dimension release?
I think it was.
Yeah, that feels
so right. You got Weinstein in there too, so it's just, you got a lot of trouble.
Well, again, I'm glad that you brought up From Dusk Till Dawn because it is around that same time of, like, Williamson shows up for the Tarantino vampire movie. All those guys are kind of having a second wind. Yeah. You know, Jim Brown is in Mars Attacks right around the same time. Yeah. Jackie Brown, you know, is obviously, like, the greatest example of that. But yeah, it's just, it feels like a trend that's happening that, you know, again, Larry Cohen being the king of, like, oh, well, here's my opportunity, you know? He just kind of cashed in some chips and was like, I get to make another movie and make some money.
Yeah, and I think Williamson brought him onto it, so it's kind of like that.
That sounds right.
That sort of thing. I think Williamson had it kind of together first.
Here's an interesting question. Out of all the movies, especially, you know, since you're kind of approaching a lot of these from the outside for the first time, what is one movie that Larry Cohen's that had a reputation or like a particular reputation that you may not have responded to the same or maybe got something else out of?
Interesting.
I know mine.
In terms of what it, how it's talked about?
Yeah.
And then your experience with it?
I don't love It's Alive. That one's a tough one for me. And people really, really like it. And I've during some of the earliest days of the Exhumed 24-hour-thon, they played both It's Alive and then It's Still Alive in the same block in back-to-back years. And
Still Alive is also a slog.
It's a slog. but I never fully latched on to It's Alive. I'm kind of the same. This was the best viewing of the stuff that I've probably ever had because I've always been resistant to that one.
Me too. And I think I turned around again on a lot of these, like the stuff I'd seen before and Q, and then I just hadn't got on its wavelength. And now I like really responded this time.
Yeah.
They're really both really fun. Honestly, special effects, like I had never seen it, and like it's more your kind of movie, it's not mine.
Fair.
So it's less, I think it's just the fact that it wasn't a lot for me there. A
little too sleazy for Martin.
Yeah.
So double feature.
Man, so there's so many you could do across these films.
I've got mine.
But I have, so I was going to do With God Told Me To.
Okay.
I have two that are a tie. Number one is Cure, the Kiyoshi Kurosawa story.
Good film. Pick.
Very similar idea of a almost like a sickness, or like you had this figure with a power that is telling people to do something,
mm-hmm.
usually kill. And the other one is Angel Heart. Very similar setup of the noir, the guy kind of chasing his own tail into this world of church, but also voodoo and magic as well. I feel like Harry Angel feels almost like a Cohen type character too.
I thought the stuff would pair well to that you bring up Kurosawa. I thought the stuff would pair well with his latest movie Cloud about this whole like consumerism and the aftermarket
and everything.
And like these resellers like getting hunted down and stuff. And like I thought it was kind of interesting because it's kind of they're both have a acidic and sideways kind of worldview when it comes to like capitalism and the open market.
But Kiyoshi Kurosawa is rarely that pulpy.
Right.
Like Cloud is very pulpy for him.
Yeah.
You know, he's usually a lot more low key but I love that movie.
My double feature is actually, I thought of this last night while I was watching Bone. And I wanted to recommend, I actually searched one of our Plex servers to make sure it's on there. It would be a great double feature of hard-to-find 70s exploitation films that deal with race relations. You would do Bone, and then you would do... Have you ever seen Fight for Your Life?
No.
Man. Okay, I'm warning everybody, if you do seek this movie out, I do apologize for what it's going to do to you, because it's not an easy sit at all, because it's all built around William Sanderson, you know, from like Blade mm-hmm. Runner and yeah, Deadwood, and he's young, and back when he was kind of acting in these very low budget exploitation movies, is a super racist, maybe the most racist character I've ever seen committed to film. And he's a small town crook who they attack this black family and do a home invasion when they're on the run, like rape, torture, all the worst parts of the Bible. But the entire thing becomes about this black religious man and trying to protect his family against this abhorrent racist who invades his house. And it has
a Straw Dogs kind of feel, almost.
Very Straw Dogsy. But the two things from the two moments from Larry Cohen's whole filmography, well, it's the entirety of Bone, because it's also like a comment of unlike how white racists, you know, emasculate black males and try to like subjugate them the entire time. And it's about him rising up and protecting his family in rather gruesome fashion as a very, I looked back and I hadn't seen it in a while. And I saw on Letterboxd, the last time, I think it was like 2017 was the last time I'd watch it. I called it Last Klan Rally on the Left.
Oh God.
So it's Like, it's a gnarly film, but it's worth watching because it's awesome. And it also has, like, this crazy funk soundtrack and, like, amazing theme song, a lot like Hell Up in Harlem and Black Caesar, like, kind of in the same vein. So I think that would pair really, really well with Bone. If you can find them, again, another Blue Underground release back in the day when Blue Underground, I think that's the only copy I still have, is an old Blue Underground DVD, A Fight for Your Life.
Yeah, hell yeah.
So remake, redo of God Told Me To. Or maybe we could broaden the playing field, we'll say, and you could pick any Larry Cohen movie you think might translate well to a modern remake.
I mean, The Stuff, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most obvious.
I mean,
You actually can't believe it hasn't been done.
No.
Because they have done a low budget It's Alive and It's Terrible.
Yep.
Recently.
Well, most of his films could, because they're so high concept.
Right.
And high concept is so easily
adaptable.
Because you lose the Coen-ness, but his stuff is so universal at the same time that I think, like, you could take his, if you have a good director.
That's what I was going to say. It would be fun is that, like, also taking the central concepts a lot, like, a great example would be, like, you know, the Hills Have Eyes remake.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Filtering, like, The Hills Have Eyes through Alexander Aja's, like,
yep.
French New Extremity kind of point of view. The Stuff really is, like, because I feel like out of all Coen's movies, maybe It's Alive is the most brand recognized, quote unquote. No pun intended, I guess, when talking about a movie about consumerism. But, like,
I mean, Q would be a lot of fun. Like, with, like,
Q would be fun, but
I don't think it's, like, necessary.
That one's also, like, it's so indebted to its time period.
Yeah.
And the actors who are in it, that I would have trouble divorcing myself from that one.
It has the perfect alchemy of everything mixed together.
Yeah.
And it's not like, the film, a lot of it's not even about Q. It's about the reaction to this monster.
The monster. Well, that almost is the most Dickensian of all of the stories that he told.
I mean, Ambulance would be cool. Like, just to, like, I mean,
well, Michael Bay did that.
Well, yeah, but, like, you think about, it's also a great high concept thing, and it's like, imagine, that would be a very easy one to adapt. You know, different city, crazy stunts, bigger budget. You know, I don't think we need to, but I think probably the stuff. I mean, you're talking about that with Cloud, of, like, in the internet culture of, like, almost like influencer culture as well. Selling things, you know, YouTube. I could do it about my world of mattresses and reviews, you know, like, it's,
well, and late also
stage capitalism.
Like, God Told Me To would be rough because of all the active shooter stuff. Like, might be tough to really get anybody to sign on to that these days. That's the other thing, is that, like, during that time period, you could get away with that now. And I think if you brought anything to anybody about and being like, well, it's about a religious spirit conspiracy that's also about aliens. Actually, now that I'm saying it out loud, it might be the most 2026 movie of all time. Here's all of these weird conspiracy nuts and aliens and mass shooters. Like, I'm selling myself as I say it out loud.
No, as you were saying it too, I was like, actually, this sounds great. Because imagine in the time of QAnon now, and also the fact that we're seeing real evidence come out of horrible things and people are ignoring it.
Like, what if Charlie Kirk was shot in the neck because somebody thought he was an alien?
I mean, like, yeah, that level of just the... And also, like, we think about the Slender Man story of those girls who tried to kill their friend because of an online creepypasta.
Right.
You know, of, like, when that becomes reality, like, that messiness between, you know, are we even going to watch the new Faces of Death
tonight? I was literally about that to bring that up.
Is, yeah, that the it's gray, like, area of reality and online, or even the film Cam, which this filmmaker also did.
Yeah, the difference between, like, frankly,
Red Rooms.
When you sit there and watch or look at the internet all day, and the rise of misinformation and fake news and everything, is that, like, discerning what is real versus what is manufactured. AI, Jesus Christ.
Well, and I just watched The Plague, the new film, from which is amazing. Very similar idea of...
You guys are way more on board with this movie than I am.
But with this film, The Plague, you have this... this setup of these kids who are at a, in 2003, at a water polo camp. And there is kind of a game they play at first of, well, that kid has the plague. You know, he has a rash. You can't touch him. You're going to get it. And it's kind of that whole idea of like in this, obviously with these boys, these teenage boys, and even now with the internet, of almost a game of telephone, is it becomes reality. You know, is what you the stories you tell and the lies you tell become reality till you believe them, you know. And it'd be interesting to see, I think, with a God told me to in internet culture.
No,
you know, so.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you sold me on that one.
I think we should do it.
Sold. So Face Melter, yay, nay.
For a God told me to?
Yeah.
For me, yes. I think Ambulance out of all these would be the one I think is a Face Melter.
Yeah, the closest to like the visceral experience. I don't think he ever really made a Face Melter. I think his movies, I love them, so many of them, and I loved him as a voice, but he was almost too cerebral to melt faces for me.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, to where I would get wrapped up in the ideas and the entertainment, but the entertainment was presented on such a lo-fi, low-budget level that it never was able to kind of reach maximalist style that allowed you to melt faces.
But again, Ambulance is the closest thing to that.
Oh, yeah.
Because you also had the Spirit Rosado's like stunts and...
Well, because Maniac Cop 2 is a face melter and like it's in the same vein as that.
Yeah.
So I see the argument.
And I would love to, if we're talking about remakes and shit, I mean, an expanded universe of like the Coenverse would be fucking awesome. If we did get that Ref and Brubaker, you know... Maniac Cop, and then do an Ambulance remake or a sequel to Ambulance, where in that world would be fucking awesome.
Well, to tell a story, I guess it's not really outside of class because unfortunately Larry Cohen died. One of the times that I met him at BMD, and I think I told this during the Maniac Cop episode too, is that during my BMD days, one of the stories I was always chasing was the Maniac Cop remake that was supposed to be at HBO as a series with Nick Reffin and Ed Brubaker and John Hyams was going to direct it. And then it fell apart. And I remember getting able to ask Larry Cohen face to face about it. And he told me straight up, he was like, I've read the script. It's pretty good. It's a lot like Mona Lisa, the old Neil Jordan movie with Bob Hoskins about this, driver who drives a prostitute around and she witnesses a crime done by the maniac cop and then the maniac cop's going after her. Sounds awesome. I would watch the shit out of that. But he did also be like, but you know what? For all I know, it's not happening. And if it is, they better call my lawyer because they owe me money. And I'm like, you got it, Larry. So, Martin, this has been great.
Yeah.
What is our next rabbit hole that we're falling down?
We are doing Rennie Harlan.
Hell yeah.
Which isn't new for me. I've seen most of them before.
Sure. I think it's also, I mean, I pitched it to you as an excuse so that we could finally sit down and watch these new Strangers films too. But, you know, I might end up regret ever mentioning the idea, but we'll see. And you'll have to stay tuned to the next episode of Secret Handshake to see how tortured I am by these terrible movies. Bye.
Bye.